Welcome to Crosstalk Podcast, where we do our best to inspire recovery from addiction and find a better way of life. Whether you're considering a life free from substance dependency or already are on that path, Crosstalk Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we do a deep dive into the experiences and stories of people who have walked the walk of recovery, alongside experts in the field to increase our understanding about addiction. Our mission is simple: to help you navigate the challenges and celebrate the victories alongside your journey to recovery to a better way of life. So buckle up and let's hit the road as we embark on this transformative journey together. This is Crosstalk Podcasts. We have a great interview today. Singer-songwriter Griffin House is with us today, and I'm really excited to meet him and for you to meet him and to learn a little bit about his story. So, Griffin, tell us a little bit about how things were growing up.
I grew up in Springfield, Ohio, which has been on the news lately a lot, which has been kind of crazy to hear my hometown on national television all the time. It's been pretty wild, but my folks are still there, divorced, but my sister's there, dad's there, he's remarried, my mom's remarried, but so I have lots of friends still, so I've been keeping up with what's going on there. But I grew up in Springfield. I think Life magazine did a feature on our town in the 1960s, and it was like the idea of the article was that it was kind of the quintessential all-American town with, you know, diversity and people from different sides of the tracks and sort of a snapshot of the heart of America as it were, you know. And so it was, I felt like I grew up in kind of a quintessential all-American town. It was, had a little bit of everything.
So growing up, mom and dad, they were together?
Yeah, they got divorced when I was 22, but yeah, our family, I would say for the most part, was pretty solid. I don't really like look back and think like, oh, I developed an addiction to alcohol because of anything in my family. I mean, I can identify some alcohol abuse for sure in certain sections of the family. But like holidays, you know, we're talking about Thanksgiving. It's like holidays at my grandparents' house on my mom's side especially were great. It was like the whole family would come and it was this big celebratory event. And I loved that. I loved being around family and just the warmth of Christmas time and Thanksgiving and having everybody together. I still love big family events for the most part. It can get difficult sometimes with extended family and stuff, but yeah, I had a good childhood. There wasn't alcoholism in my home, but I was pretty aware. Like I mentioned my grandfather, and he's a big part of my story because I kind of idolized him. He was a super cool guy. He was a great storyteller. He would talk about growing up in the Great Depression on a farm in Ohio. And then, of course, we were always proud of his service for our country and that he fought in World War II. And he would joke around and say he shot Hitler's mustache off when he was over in the war. So, you know, just like I just adored this guy, as did everybody in the family. And he was the kind of guy where, like, my grandmother would go, oh, George hasn't had a drink in 30 days. He's doing so well. And then I'd be doing my homework. They had a bar in the middle of the, a nice house and a bar in the middle of it. And I would sit behind there and do my homework. It was kind of like a square. It was big. And he'd come behind there and he'd have his non-alcoholic beer. And as my grandmother was saying, he hadn't had a drink in 30 days. He'd pull the plastic bottle of Kamchatka vodka from behind the corner and he'd wink at me and he'd pour some of the vodka in the non-alcoholic beer. And I'd just be like, and you know, so he's like setting, he's this beautiful guy, you know, that I adored, but he's kind of like setting the tone for me as like, well, if I want to be like him, then like I gotta drink and I gotta kind of sneak it too. And it's normal to enjoy it. And I had some of my first drinks. They would go away on vacation for like months at a time down to Florida or North Carolina. And my friends would go over there in high school and, you know, steal booze from the bar basically and have little parties. And that's kind of where I had some of my first drinks. But in that sense, it just felt totally normal and the thing to do. And when I go back to Springfield now, I look around and people drink there a lot. You know, it's in the Midwest. It's very normalized. It's normalized in my family. My family was full of the events were like people had a drink in their hand, you know, no one was falling down or getting in fights or calling the cops, but like alcohol was always there.
So I guess if your grandmother was saying he was doing so good, right? I guess there might actually have been a problem.
Right. Yeah, for sure. To have the kind of love and respect that he had from his family, it's and the way that everybody that sent me the message of like, this guy's living an honorable life that's full of love, creating family. I want it to be like that. So as just as a, it made sense to me to say that would be included in the way that I live my life. It's how you relax. It's how you probably deal with hard things in life, like coming home from World War II and just trying to live the American dream in an all-American town. It's like, this, that's what you do. You drink, drinking is a part of that. And so when it started to cause problems for me and I knew something was wrong and I looked up my first AA meeting online. I think I called the AA hotline when I had moved to Nashville. I was about 22 and drinking was causing problems. And I went to some of my first meetings. It wasn't a great experience for me because I couldn't imagine like growing old without having that as without having alcohol as a support system for myself emotionally. So
forever is a long time.
Forever. And there was a lot of internal conflict and resistance. It's like, I knew I wanted to do something about my drinking, but I would have preferred if there was a way where I could go take classes so they could learn, you could teach me how to control and enjoy my drinking. I kind of was always one of those people that wanted to stop, you know, I didn't really want to, or I didn't think I want to. And often to this day, I can think that my mind can tell me that thing that is in the traditions of the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I'm like, when I hear that, sometimes my mind goes, they have that totally backwards. I'm here because I want to drink. Like I'm here because I'm at these meetings because I'm trying to have you people help me push that desire down so that I can do it one day at a time. If I didn't want to drink, I wouldn't have to come here. You know, it's like, I didn't have a problem with like, say, marijuana. I don't even think about it. It's not something I don't have to go to meetings to, I don't want to, you know? So I don't know that for me, that's always backwards in my mind. I don't know if it's just my mind, but I've started to realize lately, well, maybe I am the person that doesn't want to drink because I can think that I want to still sometimes, but yet my actions by coming to a meeting like almost every day of my life tell me that, hey, maybe I don't want to.
So just going back to the early years, say around when you were 22 or so, you went to some Nashville AA, were things a little out of control before that?
In high school and stuff, I experimented around and there were times when I drank entirely too much, but again, there wasn't anything because of the company that I was keeping. I saw other people do that and there was nothing that made me think like, oh, I have a serious problem that's completely different than the other people here. I fit in that way. Even if I drank a lot, there were a lot of people that drank a lot. So it didn't seem like anything unusual. And then when I went away to college, I think one thing that sort of saved me or curbed my drinking for a long time is that I got involved in some Christian spirituality, for better, for worse, for a while in college. And I think that kept me a little on the straight and narrow for a while. I went away to Europe to study abroad and everybody drank pretty much regular, it seemed, in Europe. It was more socially accepted to just kind of you find the people that do that, but no like major problems. But then I came back my senior year and I was in a bit of a funk through going through a breakup with my college girlfriend, and I was not really doing well emotionally. And I came home and saw a family doctor and he asked me about my drinking. And he put me on some antidepressants, and I didn't really get the memo that you weren't supposed to drink on the antidepressants. So somehow the antidepressants just like ramped up my drinking through the roof. Like all of a sudden I could drink like double what I was before. And I got really out of control with that. And actually had a really bad episode the last day of school. It was I graduated that day. We were supposed to like walk outside graduation, and I got attacked by a gang of guys. I was walking my ex-girlfriend and her sister home, and had been drinking a ton, and some guy like mouthed off or something. I talked back to him, and I thought it was just one guy. And next thing I knew, there's like a gang of eight dudes around me smashing bottles over my head. And luckily, I mean, looking back on it, I'm like, I could have easily not survived that experience. And not that I caused that, but had I not been drinking, like if that happened to me today, I would tail it the hell out of there and right. avoid the situation. Whereas in that situation, I was, you know, meeting aggression with aggression.
Nothing happened to the girls.
Nothing happened to the girls. They got away, saw what happened to me. I woke up in the hospital, went home. But that was sort of the beginning of realizing what was going on. And then I just kind of became...
You were 21 at that point?
I was 22. And then I went on and started to live the musician's life, you know? And a lot of people in my circle of musician friends drank and were out on the road 200 days a year. And every night you're in a bar, people are buying you drinks. And, you know, it just... You don't even have to be drinking that fast, but if you start when you get to the venue loading in and you don't get out of there until one, you know, you've had a lot of drinks by the end of the night, and then you go to the next town and you do it again. And it just kind of became part of life, you know, just drinking really excessive amounts was part of life. And I liked it. I liked the way that it made me feel. I liked that I felt relaxed, more myself. And it was just, it was really hard to...
It was normal.
Yeah, it was normal. Totally normal. And hard to think about living without. And still sometimes is mentally, even though it's not physically anymore. There's a lot of emotional baggage with it. But that's why I work really hard to stay sober.
So I don't want to rush things along, but I'm kind of curious. Are we getting into a discussion of your bottom, as they say?
I mean, I don't know... I never really felt like I had a bottom, because when I came to that first AA meeting it was called Davidson Road in Nashville, you know, they talked about the importance of a bottom. And they, I remember some of the old timers there was like, well, you saw the elevator going down and you got off at whatever floor. And I knew I kind of wasn't ready, but I was just trying to do the right thing at that time. And then it took me, I went back out after a couple months, just decided I'd overreacted. Maybe I wasn't really an alcoholic or wasn't really ready. And at that time, AA was really different too. You know, I didn't have friends that were getting sober like I do now. Like mm-hmm. Some of my best friends in the music world now are calling me 20 years later, and people I never thought I'd get, never would see sober. I just sat in a meeting in Nashville last week with one of my best friends from when I first moved to Nashville, a very successful producer in Nashville, and never thought I'd be sitting in a meeting with him. And I had this like massive God moment, you know, sitting there with him. And it was beautiful to have that kind of confirmation. I wish we could have done that together when I started. It was lonely to do it by myself, you know, and the people around me kind of looked at me like, oh, are you just being holier than thou? Or are you trying to like be better than us by getting sober? Like, now you got to be better than us by getting sober. It was like a competition thing or something. Just not a lot of support. Not a lot of support from my family, even though maybe they tried to be, but didn't know how to be.
What year is this?
This is like, the first time was 2003 probably. And then when I really did it for real, started on the real journey, I would say it was like 2010. And that was shortly after I got married to my wife now, Jane, who we've been married for 15 and a half years. And that was like the first time that I realized the jig was kind of up. But I was a pretty good negotiator, I guess. And I would let people know how miserable I was in sobriety for many years without my best friend alcohol. So, you know, I would tough it out for like a year. I'd tough it out for a year and a half, and then I'd go back out. And I made it about 6 years with a sponsor in Nashville. And like that was my longest stretch. And so my most recent sobriety date is June 21 of 2022. And I say most recent, I hope I can keep it, you know, for forever. But I've learned a lot along the way. And, you know, I think as we've heard in, or as I've heard in some other meetings, it's like, I look back on that time and I don't really see the relapses as bad. I try to look at the whole bigger picture of like, well, I was sober like most of that 20 years. I stayed out of a lot of trouble. I learned a lot of stuff. I did a lot of work. I wish it was continuous, but you know, part of coming in early is that it's not easy to always get it, you know. And I can hear judgment in the room sometimes from old timers that talk about relapse like it's not necessary or whatever. But then I say back to them, it's like, well, yeah, but you didn't come in till you were 60, bro. Like I came in when I was 23. Try doing that. It's not easy mentally. At least it wasn't for me. I mean, I certainly admire long-term sobriety. I'm trying to work on it for myself, but I'm kind of more like the world record for sobriety is 24 hours a day, right?
So I'm curious about when did you drop the shame?
I think when I realized that if I didn't get back on track, which to me for some reason was like 30 days, like I got to clean my system out for 30 days. I think somehow I had heard that it takes that long for alcohol to get out of your system, really. So I was like, yeah, if I can't do that pretty soon, I'm not going to have a choice but to like go get some assistance with that, some form of rehab or detox. So eventually it took, and I just kept going back until I got 30 days. And then
okay. So today, you have a lot of balance in your life, wife, kids, a lot of responsibility. What kind of things do you do today to maintain your balance, to maintain your sobriety that people might want to hear about?
I go to a meeting every day. Sometimes twice a day. Not always because I feel like I need it, but sometimes I just want to, and I'm in that space where it seems like a good idea. There's lots of good meetings around, and I've developed friendships with people in the recovery community that I actually want to go connect with my friends, you know. And I think there's something a gentleman shared at the meetings this morning about just the fellowship aspect of AA and how that's the really powerful bond that keeps us sober every bit as much as the step work and everything else. And I find that to be true. There's something about physically bringing my body to a meeting and sitting my butt in a chair that sends a signal to my brain of like, this is what we're doing now, you know, and sort of the actions speak louder than words. Phrase is like, when I bring my body to a meeting, I sit down, I make that commitment to myself, and I start doing it every day. It just starts to become part of who I am and part of my routine and part of my life. So I start pretty much every day with a meeting at my home group at 7:30, and I throw some other meetings in there over the course of the week, some men's meetings or meetings at night. And I try to hit meetings on the road, and I just don't really know anything else. You know, I'm sure there's some different, I know there are different ways to recover or different ways to do it, but I found AA at a young age. And so that's kind of my path. I guess I'm allowed to say that without press, radio, and film. Does podcast count? I don't know.
So Griffin, what do you do for fun? I think it's important for our listeners, especially people that are new in sobriety, to know that it's possible to have fun. I'd love for you to talk a little bit, when you're not playing concerts, what do you do to have fun? And is it possible to have fun being sober?
I'm not sure I'm the poster boy for being able to tell people how to do all these fun, exciting things in sobriety. I'm lucky enough that I played a lot of sports growing up and have always been pretty active, but I was a pretty good golfer. And I turned down a golf scholarship when I was getting ready to go. I had a golf scholarship offer to go to Ohio University, but I was burnt out and couldn't play music at that point. I didn't even know how to play guitar yet and learned until I went away to Miami. But I kind of hated it. Like at that point in my life, it was just like so wrapped up in the way I felt about myself. It was like performance, self-worth, all that stuff. And I didn't think I was good enough to play for a living anyway. So I kind of left that behind me and wanted to run far away from it. But it's come back into my life in a way that I feel like recreationally I enjoy it a lot. I find it pretty spiritual too. It's like I'm outside. I love being outside. Mm-hmm. I love hitting the ball around. I love how it feels to just like, it's like, I don't know, hitting a baseball. It's like you hit a home run, you watch a thing sail over the fence. Golf's kind of like that. When you hit a good shot, there's something kind of zen about it and spiritual. I enjoy it. I enjoy the company. So I spend a lot of time doing that, and I'm thankful for it because I think it keeps me busy and keeps me out of trouble, and I do find it really fun. So it's a hobby that I really enjoy, and other than that, I just try to exercise and enjoy my kids, and could always use more fun, though. If you got any ideas, throw them at me.
So I have one other question I want to ask you that we ask a lot of guests. And the question, some people say, I wish you didn't ask me that question. Others, the answer just slides right off of their tongue. The question is, if you had the opportunity to speak to young Griffin House, pick the age, whatever age it might be, what kind of advice would you give young Griffin if you had that opportunity based on the experience that you've had in your adult life?
About what's to come. That's a really interesting question. The first thing that popped into my head was believe in yourself, don't doubt yourself, but also the question of would I tell him not to drink or not? I don't know. Because I question a lot of times whether some of the things that I think I wanted out of life would have been a lot easier if I hadn't been energetically sidetracked by a lot of the alcohol abuse. But then at the same time, I wouldn't be sitting here. I wouldn't have all these gifts of sobriety. I wouldn't be connected with my friends and found all the meaning of actually having to give up something that you think that you love that's no good for you. So it's almost like, I don't know if I would just tell him to trust his gut more and not be afraid to do that and just to not give up, you know, like if I could go back and say that, which I guess is probably what I need to hear in my life right now, you know. But it's interesting that you asked that question because I've been thinking a lot about that like 13-year-old boy and who I was before alcohol came into my life at all. And there was a gentleman sharing a story last night at a meeting, and he was talking about like how much trouble he got into, and he came from a really different family background than I came from. So I was identifying but comparing too, and I was thinking about how it's like, man, I was actually a pretty good kid. Like I can recall like two instances where I kind of did something bad, but they were like, I didn't really mean to do them. It's like, you know, I was always trying to be a gentleman. I was trying to do the right thing. And then somehow, you know, alcohol found me and I found it. And I'm curious about what the path would have been had that not happened, or if I had had somebody in my life that said, you should probably just stay away from that. You know, it's not worth it. But then who knows? Like, maybe it would, everything's the way it's supposed to be.
Well, Griffin, thank you so much for being here today. I so enjoyed our interview together. I hope everybody else out there enjoyed it as much as I did. And, you know, I can't wait for this to drop, and I'm sure we're going to get a lot of feedback, great feedback, because I really enjoyed this today. And for you out there, I want to thank you for watching. Thanks for listening, and see you next time on Crosstalk Podcasts.